You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Good afternoon. I think we'll get started if that's okay. My name is John Palfrey, and on behalf of the Harvard Law School Library, delighted to welcome you here to a lunchtime talk by Professor Danner of Duke. We are just thrilled that he has agreed to come give this talk with us today. I'm joined in welcoming Professor Danner also by the Office of Scholarly Communications. Representatives Sue and Bob Darnton are here to be thanked for that leadership. Also the Berkman Center for jointly hosting this event. And thank you to all of you from the Harvard campus and beyond who've come to hear this address. Professor Danner is someone in the law library community who literally needs no introduction. In looking over his CV, he's someone who has climbed every mountain in our business. He's been the editor of the Law Library Journal for a decade. He has been the president of the American Academy of American Association of Law Librarians. He's also been, for a long time, the director of the Duke Law Library, which when I, as a rookie law library director, asked people what I should look at as a model, most of the roads led to Duke. And I feel like I've learned so much from what he's done in his leadership on open access and so many other topics. I'm just thrilled to hear the story directly from Professor Danner. I want to make one logistical note, which is we are being recorded. It's not live webcast, but it will be put on the web. The camera will be trained on the person up here, but I do hope that you will speak up and ask questions and so forth, but just know that when you do so, you are being recorded for posterity and are on notice as such. But Professor Danner, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, John, and thanks to the Law Library and the Berkman Center and the Office of Scholarly Communication for having me come here. I have to say that, you know, my reputation, I think, has increased many times since John has gone around and said these things about me. So for those of you who know me better, listen to him and not by what you really know to be the case. I've mentioned to a couple of people, I gave a talk yesterday at Duke. We had a workshop there for the law.gov project, which is, many of you probably know, is an effort to try to create a digital repository of mainly primary sources of U.S. law. And I did this, was part of this workshop, did my talk, and was given an assignment for a subject to talk about. And as I mentioned to John earlier, after I had written up the talk, prepared slides for it, I looked seriously at the title and realized that the title had nothing to do with what I had prepared to speak about. Here, after I was asked to do this, Michelle asked me a couple of times before I responded what the title of my talk should be. And finally, I had to come up with one. And I just wanted to tell you in advance that this time around, there are many elements to the title, but I think I will touch on each one of them over the course of our time together. So the title of the talk, if you don't have it, is Taming Multiplicity in the Post-Print Era, Law Librarians, Legal Scholarship, and Access to the Law. In 2002, I was privileged to share a podium at Yale with Morris Cohen, who served as the law librarian at Harvard from 1971 to 1981 before he moved on to Yale, where he retired in 2003. And for those of you who don't know, Morris Cohen is one of the giants of law librarianship. He's a major author. One of his major accomplishments is a bibliography of early American law, which he began in 1984, finished in 1998 in six volumes, then came up with another volume-length supplement about 5 years later. Morris's charge for our presentation, which was to a group of international law librarians, was to provide an historical overview of American law publishing. Mine was to discuss contemporary and future directions in American legal research, a topic that, at that time, I developed around Carl Llewellyn's concept of the threat of the available, which he defined as the almost inevitable tendency in any study first to turn to the most available material, to study that, to study it exclusively, and then, having once begun the study of the available, to lose all perspective and come shortly to mistake the merely available, the easily seen, for all there is to see. In his own talk, using an array of slides and images, Morris guided our audience through several hundred years of legal publishing in England and America, concluding with a description of how, in the 1880s, American law publishers, most notably the West Publishing Company from St. Paul, Minnesota, produced a series of bibliographic innovations which were to shape legal research for at least the next 100 years, services that were designed to meet the needs of the common law system. Supplementation and updating of primary sources so lawyers would always have the most current version of the law available. Subject access, the material that was mostly published chronologically. Authority verification of primary sources and access to descriptive and interpretive secondary sources. Most importantly, though, these new tools also helped to integrate and cross-reference what Morris referred to as the multiplicity of legal sources for the convenience of researchers. After saying basically what I just reported to you, Morris continued on for a bit, but for the most part, he'd reached the end of his story. Those late 19th century innovations in legal publishing remained at the core of the U.S. legal information system until the last quarter of the 20th century when the legal research databases, Lexis and Westlaw, were introduced. But at our program, that was my story to tell. Morris's use of the phrase multiplicity of legal sources, however, to describe the late 19th century legal information environment linked directly back to how lawyers at that time had described what they saw as an overwhelming number of published sources, mostly cases, judicial opinions, with which they needed to deal. Not bothered at all by Llewellyn's threat of the available, many American lawyers back at that time felt the need to be what were called case lawyers, to find every case possibly on point for their issue in order to resolve the problem. Yet, while they wanted to see every case, the ever-growing number of published opinions swamped them. The complaint at that time about the number of sources with which American lawyers had to deal was neither new nor was it unusual. Common law lawyers working in systems that rely heavily on the precedents found in judicial opinions had complained about having too many opinions, too much law to deal with, going back at least to the early 17th century. And this continued in the U.S. after the American Revolution. In 1810, there were fewer than 20 volumes of American case law in the U.S., yet only a few years later, in an address to the Suffolk Bar, Joseph Story warned of the fearful calamity which threatens us of being buried alive, not in the catacombs, but in the labyrinths of the law. When he published the first volume of his commentaries on American law, James Kent noted the consequences of the number of books which beset and encumber the path of the student, and the evils resulting from indigestible heaps of laws and authorities which destroy the certainty of the law and promote litigation, delay, and subtlety. I don't know what was wrong with subtlety, but that was one of the things he was concerned about. When he wrote in 1826, there were perhaps 200 volumes of American court reports. In 1940, the American Jurist commented that many young lawyers now find themselves in the dilemma of Erasmus, called upon to select between law books and clothes. After the Civil War, the body of American law grew steadily, perhaps exponentially, spurred by geographic expansion, economic growth, increases in the numbers of courts and judges issuing opinions, and by the publication of court reports, opinions, in unofficial reporters of decisions, as well as in the official reports issued by the states or by the federal government. Throughout the last quarter of the century, the annual meetings of the American Bar Association rang with calls to reduce the multiplicity of decisions being issued by the courts and published an often duplicative series of reports. In 1885, it was noted that for the decisions of 11 states, alternative versions were available in two to three formats, in two to three sets, in addition to the official reports published by the states. And from then on, as I said, American lawyers, law students, scholars, and everyone working with the law was awash in a constantly rising sea of legal information, staying afloat only because of the tools that were created by West and other legal publishers. Of course, West itself, despite coming up with these finding tools and organizing the law, was a major contributor to the problem because of its own program of comprehensive, convenient, and inexpensive publication of state and federal appellate opinions. As Morris Cohen put it, the materials of our law seem to be marked by an accelerating birth rate an almost non-existent mortality rate, and a serious resistance to contraception on the part of both judges and legislators. Yet, throughout the 20th century, despite the amount of law to contend with, American law librarians, a profession which began really in the early part of the 20th century, could feel that they had some control over the literature of the law. In 1975, about the time that Westlaw and Lexis, the legal research databases, were first introduced, there were an estimated 3 million reported decisions, with 44,000 being added each year. Bob Baring, who has often written on these subjects, compared, however, the role of West's tools in providing and maintaining a shape to the common law to something similar to that which was played by Blackstone's commentaries in the 18th century. Despite its continuing growth, the literature of the law was organized and findable. Law librarians knew and understood how the digest system worked, knew how to use loose leaf services and pocket parts to update volumes, understood the mysteries of shepherdizing, and were experts in the arcane rules of the Blue Book citation system, which the Harvard Law Review first foisted on legal writers in 1926. And law librarians had little reason throughout this period to question the value of their work or whether there might be other ways to do the things that they do. Yet, around 1975, the time that the databases first began to be introduced, Christine Brock wrote a revisionist history of law librarians and libraries in which she described American law libraries and the people who worked in them as being locked in a bondage relationship with the legal profession. And throughout much of their history, law librarians have identified more closely with lawyers than they have with other librarians. In 1935, the American Association of Law Libraries voted to hold its annual meetings with the American Bar Association rather than with the American Library Association. American law librarians tolerated, perhaps happily, the painfully slow development of the Library of Congress class K system for law for decades after the rest of the LC system was declared complete in 1939. Law librarians have also favored legal education over library education for law librarians. One library director noted at a panel discussion about the education of law librarians in 1958 that her own feeling was that the less library science you have, the better. It will only foul things up. Brock argued that this relationship, both relationships, too close to the law, too far away from librarianship, had hindered law librarianship throughout the 20th century and left law librarians isolated from innovations that had benefited the rest of the library profession. And the introduction of Lexis and Westlaw in the mid-1970s ultimately changed things, but it didn't immediately transform the law librarian's work. As Baring has pointed out, at first, these were very conservative innovations which aped the functions of the old print system. They were designed, something unusual for the time, to attract end-user lawyers rather than intermediaries to do the search. They were marketed to attract lawyers to use them, and Westlaw itself was originally put out as an index to the cases that were published in West books rather than the full-text system that it quickly became. In the 1980s, legal information became widely accessible in digital formats to law students, professors, lawyers, judges, and others who use the information via Lexis, Westlaw, CD-ROM products, some competing products at the time to Lexis and Westlaw. Lawyers became much more used to using electronic sources to do their research. By the 1990s, of course, legal information was also becoming increasingly available to wider audiences through the internet and the World Wide Web, while a new variety of non-legal sources of information became readily available to legal professionals. Just as 100 years earlier, lawyers, law librarians, and others working with legal information were faced with a multiplicity of sources, now there was a new multiplicity of sources for American lawyers and others to work with, many of which fell outside the controlled apparatus of the established print systems. Fred Schauer and Virginia Wise found that once they had ready electronic access to materials outside the usual coverage of Lexis and Westlaw and the books in the law library, courts were more and more frequently citing authorities other than cases and statutes in their decisions. By the end of the century, in the midst of all of this, Baring was calling for a new Blackstone, someone who can reconceptualize the structure of legal information. At the same time, law librarians were forced to consider the impacts of information technologies on their libraries and on their profession, and also to think harder about what they had in common with other information professionals outside their own area of specialization. In 1996, a report of the American Association of Law Libraries Special Committee on the Renaissance of Law Librarianship in the Information Age attempted to position law librarians to take a leadership role in the churning information environment of the time. The report emphasized that the mission of the profession should be to serve both the information needs of the legal profession and also the legal information needs of the public. And the report also noted that the things that law librarians do, the traditional things identified with librarianship, acquiring, collecting, organizing, retrieving, and disseminating legal and related information, are to be thought of only as subsets of that basic service mission. I was a member of that committee, and about the same time I published a paper which I called Redefining a Profession. And that paper, not very controversially, I thought, argued that librarian was indeed a profession grounded in service. And I suggested the need for law librarians to collaborate with the legal information technologists who are a growing presence in law schools and legal practice. Point was that despite differences in skills and training, librarians and technologists ought to share a common orientation towards service. And both were working to provide the context in which legal information could be used productively to develop new knowledge or practically to solve problems out there in the real world. And I also argued that law librarians had the opportunity in this environment to take a leadership role in developing a new technology-savvy profession of legal information professionals. So, with the profession now redefined, I went on to other work. In 2008, James Donovan, a law librarian at the University of Georgia, however, wrote a paper that challenged the idea that service could be the basis for a librarian's professional status. From Donovan's perspective, the traditional roles of the library, acquiring, collecting, organizing, retrieving, disseminating, themselves created independent obligations toward collection development and toward the organization and preservation of knowledge and information in all of its form. Obligations which, for Donovan, extend beyond immediate patron services. As he wrote, it is commitment to these higher ends, ends that are not reducible to patron services or satisfactions alone, that elevates librarianship to the status of a profession. Echoing in some ways Ranganathan's laws of library science, Donovan set out the librarian's core functions as to acquire the right books, to make them accessible, and to assure their continued availability. And he concluded by saying that collection development is perhaps the cardinal function of the library. Well, in the 21st century, this just can't really be all that there is to it. How much of this work, as we look toward the future, collection development, collection building, is there going to be? Certainly, the reason for law librarians' efforts to select and organize and preserve legal information has to be not for the sake of itself, but to enable those who need that information both to find it and to use it effectively. As John Palfrey wrote recently, libraries must perceive our primary function is serving communities rather than building collections. Yet, arguing for the viability of service as a basis for the profession of librarianship may have been easier 15 years ago when we first tried to do it than in the digital environment, where I think it's necessary to think again about what services users of legal information are likely to require and whether law librarians are likely to be positioned to provide them. Most prognosticators on the future of libraries and librarians see little reason for librarians to be complacent regarding their future roles in a changing information environment. Many criticize the profession for having realized too late that the internet had dramatically diminished the value of local collections and services, and failing to recognize that digital information is really not the same thing as print information, despite the initial attraction of pretending that it is simply a different format for the same thing. And in academic libraries, there's plenty of evidence that direct electronic access to information, to the stuff of scholarship, has affected faculty use of the library and perceptions of its role. A 2008 Ithaca report suggests a growing disconnection between faculty perceptions and librarians' perceptions regarding what role the library plays in support of research and scholarship. Based on surveys conducted in 2000, 2003, and 2006, the Ithaca study found that university faculty continue to value the library, but that they also perceive themselves to be less and less dependent on the library for the research and teaching, and they anticipate their dependence to decline in the future. The survey showed that faculty continue to value the library's roles as purchaser of resources, archive for resources, and for providing a gateway to research information. Yet the most recent survey reported on also found that, with some variations by discipline, that faculty see the library's gateway role, the role of providing the means to get the information needed for scholarship, was the role that was likely to be less important over time into the future. Suggesting, therefore, that faculty perceptions of the library's importance are based more on tangible library resources, collections, than on librarians' value in locating information. As I said, the results differed by discipline. Humanities scholars continue to place more importance on the library's gateway role than those in the hard sciences, with social sciences, including legal scholars, somewhere between the two. The report also suggested that faculty perceptions about the decreasing importance of the library's role as a gateway to information were in stark contrast to librarians' sense of the importance of that role. Over 90% of the librarians who were surveyed saw the gateway role as very important, and almost as many expected it to remain so, as naturally we would, as we see local collections seem to be being used less and less by the scholars we serve. In the current issue of EDUCAUSE Review, Richard Katz argues that the information and scholarly communication environments that are emerging in the digital age are empowering scholars and are enriching scholarship in palpable ways by providing rapid, low-cost connection with others, tools that promote our capacity for multitasking, multiprocessing, and otherwise dividing our attention, and access to an abundance of easily discovered, recorded knowledge. For Katz, the greatest boon to scholarship is the last of these three, because it frees scholars from what he calls the busyness of scholarship, the tyranny and the expense of finding, acquiring, sorting, verifying, annotating, collating, validating, and classifying information. Before the internet, much research entailed tasks of looking endlessly through search age, waiting for the machinery of interlibrary loan exchanges of materials to issue forth, and earning the right to delight finally in gaining access to rolls of nearly unreadable microfilm. Now, says Katz, the discovery of rich content is mediated and simplified by search engines. The data that's found can be compiled into databases, annotated, and the results can become a personal library that is richly annotated and fully searchable by the scholar. For Katz, this is the liberating impact of digital technologies on the scholarship of discovery. For librarians, however, the suggestion that things that sound a lot like library research are considered to be a matter of busyness to scholars might be read more starkly as they really don't need us. And no doubt this important lesson from the Ithaca report applies to law as it does to other fields. The report says, the library is in many ways falling off the radar screens of faculty. And although scholars report general respect for libraries and librarians, researchers no longer use the library as a gateway and no longer feel a significant dependence on the library in their research process. So in short, although librarians may still be providing significant value to their constituency, the value of their brand may be decreasing. So how do we maintain and improve the brand? Are we positioned to provide the services our communities need? Stanley Katz, at a recent colloquium on the law librarian's role in the scholarly enterprise, said that digital scholarship is by definition collaborative. This is a challenge, he said, to the humanities tradition of lonely scholarship, but it's also a challenge to the tradition that has been dominant in law schools. Now, as they consider the future of their own profession, law librarians and other librarians often argue that greater collaboration with faculty, becoming partners in their research, is essential to the future of the profession. And this is something we've talked about in librarianship forever, forever meaning since when I was in library school. But it has proven to be something much easier to discuss among ourselves to propose than to put into practice. It's not something that scholars raise among themselves or talk to us about. To work effectively with faculty, law librarians have to know more than a professor's current research interests. We must also be clear about the cultural differences between librarians and the creators of scholarship, and how the internet has impacted the relationships between the two groups. The Ithaca study and Katz's article give us some sense about that. But research on library-faculty relationships, library and faculty relationship, consistently shows that the barriers to collaborations are significant. Our cultures are thought to be different. Typically, the culture of libraries is thought to encourage sharing, cooperation, and collaboration, while that of faculty is more likely to be that, to be one which values scholarly work more highly and to maintain exclusive control over teaching and research projects. Now, clearly that's changing because collaborative and interdisciplinary scholarship is growing in importance in law as it is in other fields. However, when they think of collaboration, professors and other scholars think in terms of working with faculty in other fields. They're not disposed to think of librarians as fellow faculty members, nor to consider librarianship a field of study or a discipline like their own or like those in other academic departments. Collaborators are co-authors of published research papers. Librarians are much more likely to be acknowledged for their contributions in a footnote. Now, in part, of course, this disconnection is based in the faculty's view that librarians work is service-oriented. We're a service profession, unlike their own work, which focuses on the production and the dissemination of knowledge. Because they rarely encounter librarians doing things other than provide reference service, they have little sense of other things that librarians might be doing, conducting and publishing their own research, creating new systems for accessing information, developing new techniques for searches, developing collections, and teaching courses. So based on what they see, faculty end up having little reason to think of librarians in roles beyond providing services in support of their own research and teaching. And as I said, we are a service profession. It's well established that the concept of academic discipline is crucial to how faculty members think about matters of status and relationships within the university. And when they think about research, scholars have in mind a fundamental process aimed at advancing the body of knowledge within their own discipline. Law professors understand the research process in their own field and know that something similar takes place in other disciplines. Because they understand that interdisciplinary research may provide powerful new insights into their own work, they seek collaborative relationships with scholars from outside their own discipline. So if we think about collaboration and if we think about interdisciplinary activities, from a disciplinary perspective, what potential for scholarly collaboration does a law librarian bring to the table? Now, in the academy, of course, law is a recognized discipline, a field of study like many others. In addition, the standard subjects taught in law school courses, as well as areas of specialized legal practice or scholarly research, are themselves often referred to as legal disciplines. Constitutional law is a discipline, as is intellectual property. The law librarians, though, have a field of study, an area in which there's a body of knowledge to be learned, developed, and nourished. At times, law librarians have argued that legal research provides the substantive discipline for their field. Yet, not only law librarians, but also law professors in other fields, attorneys, paralegals, and other legal professionals also engage in legal research, write about it, and teach it. It seems unlikely that were law librarians to attempt to to claim legal research as their discipline, that legal writing teachers particularly would be willing to cede that field to them. But what is our discipline? In 1975, about the time that Christine Brock published her critical history of law librarianship, Peter Nickum of the Lewis and Clark Law School offered a paper called Legal Research, the Unrecognized Legal Discipline. And he began with the observation that legal research is not unrecognized as existing, rather, it is unrecognized as being of any consequence. Despite its age, Nickum's paper is a still valuable recounting of reasons why the importance of legal research is not recognized by legal educators or by the practicing bar. At the time, however, Nickum found hope in the then new field of information science. He referenced an article by Jesse Shearer, who argued that information science would provide the theoretical base for the practice of librarianship. So what Nickum did was to call for the blending of these two disciplines, law and information science, to create a unified, specialized discipline of legal information science. Sketching out what would be needed to develop this new discipline, Nickum stated that leadership for the field will have to come from either the law schools or the practicing bar or zealous individuals. Noticeably absent, though, from his list of who would drive the development of this new field were law librarians. Nickum believed law librarians would not be able to take leadership in this effort for three reasons. One was their lack of initiative, understanding, and creativity with information science. The other was the administrative responsibilities involved in running a law library, of course. Also, his third reason was that the number of law librarians who could contribute to the intellectual and theoretical base of legal information science is very small. Why is the base so small? Well, he attributed this to the fact that at the time he wrote, 1974, 1975, only 15% of law librarians held degrees in both law and in library or information sciences. Now, his paper was presented at the ABA's Second National Conference on Automated Law Research in 1974, and like many attempts then and since to predict the impacts of newly emerging technologies on the practice of law and legal research, these early papers anticipated neither the rapidity nor the extent to which technology would impact legal research and legal information. As it turned out, the new discipline of legal information science did not develop. Beginning in the 1980s, however, about the middle of that decade, however, the impacts of information technologies of the law began to foster a rich literature on the role of legal information on the development of the law, spurred by the writings of Bob Baring and Ethan Katch and other law librarians besides Bob, as well as those of law professors, historians, and scholars in the information sciences. This literature became interdisciplinary and international in scope. At a 2006 conference, reviewing the contributions of Baring and others, it was obvious that this literature remains vital, wide-ranging, and that there is evidence that it is becoming recognized by legal scholars, perhaps in the way that Peter Nickum hoped that legal information science would. Today, there's a social science research network, SSRN e-journal, which makes available new scholarship on the topic of legal information and technology in the same ways that it makes available new scholarship for other legal disciplines. And many of those papers are written by law librarians, belying Nickum's doubts that the profession could make meaningful contributions to the development of its own knowledge base. There are also programs showcasing new scholarship by law librarians at annual meetings of the Association of American Law Schools, just as there are for other disciplines. And there are three established U.S.-based journals publishing scholarship in the field. So perhaps something like the discipline that Nickum envisaged in the 1970s is beginning to emerge. Whether it will be recognized by scholars in other legal disciplines and seen as suitable for collaboration in the ways they might collaborate with other faculty, I think, is less clear. So if we go back to, how long has that been out there? If we go back to what Stanley Katz said about scholarship in the digital age being by definition collaborative, We still need to answer this question of what the role is that librarians are going to play within that collaborative space where scholars work and knowledge is created in order for them to work productively with the scholars whose work they support. What will they do within that space? What is their role if it is not the sort of true collaboration between peers that engages full-time substantive faculty scholars? Law librarians, at a 2009 workshop on the future of the academic law library, tried to articulate a value proposition to make clear the unique or distinct value they brought to the workplace. But the discussions themselves suggested how difficult it was to construct value propositions that rise beyond either platitudes or restatements of the usefulness of the things that law librarians have traditionally done to support the missions of their institutions. Recent professional writings suggest the sorts of things that law librarians ought to be engaging in to support faculty scholarship. Some traditional, some emerging. Faculty liaisons, faculty services positions, electronic current awareness services to bring new information to the attention of faculty. Construction of empirical research programs that utilize the skills of empirically trained graduate students, one of whom is in this room, to provide support for faculty engaging in empirical research. Providing greater exposure to faculty scholarship by developing open access repositories of faculty publications, and doing other things to push the work of scholarship along. What else should we be doing? Most of these things assume that legal scholars increasingly will also require assistance in finding and manipulating information relevant to their research projects, something that the studies of faculty perceptions of law librarians calls into question. So what else should we be doing? Library historians have noted that at the turn of the 20th century, librarians were not only the guardians of information, but they were also the primary creators of indexes and other finding tools. Stuart Sutton suggested that this role ended sometime after the First World War, when, as he put it, the profession went to sleep and its practitioners became mere tool users, losing much of the power to enable the profession. Kenneth Carpenter argued that as American universities came increasingly to focus on the creation of knowledge rather than on its dissemination, academic occupations focusing on dissemination have been devalued. And within that environment, he says, librarians have not helped their situation by being passive disseminators rather than pursuing an active and intellectual role in providing access to the contents of material. So perhaps faced with the new multiplicity of sources of the 21st century, it's time for us to become tool builders once again, to develop the technical expertise to add value to the information we collect or provide access to use our expertise to create knowledge as well as to facilitate access to it. Jerry Campbell has written that without deep technical proficiency, librarians are a step removed from being able to conceptualize, design, and re-engineer the information and delivery systems of the near future. And are the tools that the vendors have supplied all that good? Recent reviewers have mostly smiled at the efforts during the last few months of LexisNexis and Westlaw to keep their high-priced premium legal research tools relevant to present-day researchers used to working with Google and other search engines. And is Google Scholar really all that it could be? Is it really all that useful? In law, other than for the Index to Legal Periodicals, which was initiated by the American Association of Law Libraries and first published as part of Law Library Journal, tool building was not done by librarians. As I've said, it was done by West and Shepherd's and perhaps by other publishers in the print era, then by Lexis and Westlaw. Now, perhaps, by initiatives such as the Free Access to Law movement, by law.gov, both of which I'll say more about in a second. It may well be time, however, for law librarians to consider the environments in which those tools were developed, both historically and now, and are being developed for the future. I think the question is whether or not law librarians can be the new Blackstones, the someones that Bob Baring called for to reconceptualize the structure of legal information, just as Blackstone's commentaries did in the 18th century, and as John B. West and his associates did in the face of the multiplicity of sources that American lawyers faced in the late 1800s. I think to do this, we must think a lot harder about our role in open access. Duke Law School takes open access to legal materials very seriously. At Duke, we actually don't have an open access librarian, but some of our faculty like to refer to us as the Open Access Law School, a point in which I think we all take some pride. Our scholarship repository has been open since December 2005. We have nearly 1,800 papers written by our faculty available there. The journals, there are now 9 of them that are published at Duke Law School, have been freely available on the web since 1998. Harvard's leadership in open access is, of course, also well known. Like other universities, Duke University recently developed a university-wide open access policy similar to those adopted by the law school and by other schools at Harvard. And, of course, the law school does have an open access library, and that's why I'm here. Growing amounts of legal scholarship are freely accessible on the internet through open access repositories at Duke, through the university repository at Harvard, at Yale, at Georgetown, at Cornell, and a number of other law schools, and also on law journal sites at these schools as well. The primary sources of law are also increasingly available here in the U.S. and abroad through the free access to law movement, and perhaps in the future through Carl Malamud's law.gov project, which is designed to develop a national digital registry and repository of authenticated primary sources. Through the projects of the Legal Information Preservation Alliance, through the Legal Information Institute at Cornell. All of these projects promise in one way or another improved standards for preservation and authentication and access to legal sources. Now, I'm a firm believer in John Walensky's access principle. This is the idea that if you provide open, that providing open access to scholarship is not merely a good thing to do, but is indeed an obligation. For Walensky, the transformation from print to online means that not only researchers and scholars, but also scholarly societies, publishers, and research libraries have now to ask themselves whether they are using new technologies to do as much as they can to advance and improve access to research and scholarship. It's the idea that a commitment to the value and quality of scholarly research carries with it the responsibility to extend the circulation of the work as far as possible to all who are interested in it and to all who might profit by it. And I believe this is an obligation and includes everyone who is part of the scholarly communications process, particularly librarians. I noted earlier John's statement that libraries now must perceive our primary function as serving communities rather than building collections. What we need to bear in mind is that open access repositories and web-based journals expose the scholarship of our institutions to broader, indeed, to worldwide audiences, both within and outside the academy, thereby expanding the communities we serve behind the walls of our own law schools and universities, not only to academic institutions elsewhere, but also to anyone seeking knowledge about the law. Walensky argues that open access moves knowledge from the closed cloisters of the privileged and well-endowed universities of Europe and North America to institutions worldwide, and encourages a freer flow of information in both directions, thereby creating the means for scholars everywhere to contribute to the discourse within their discipline. Now, of course, law school scholarship repositories and open access law journals, from another perspective, merely add to the multiplicity of sources with which legal researchers and others must deal. But they also may create opportunities for librarians to add value and to create new knowledge, and also to help tame the multiplicity of sources. Writing at the turn of this century, Baring envisioned a complex legal information environment in which researchers will yearn for guidance and the reliability of individual expertise, and for more personal, more interactive, and more specialized information systems in order to hold things together. To make their open access initiatives in law schools and at the university level truly valuable, to provide this kind of guidance, librarians are going to need, as John has written, to write more code and also to dig deeper into the culture of information access that our users are increasingly a part of, for good and for ill. As more and more legal materials become available for free on the web, law librarians will need to understand tools and tool building in order to collaborate with others who are committed not only to making the law available on websites, but also to making it meaningfully accessible and available and understandable to those who use it. Law librarians are well aware of the longtime efforts of Cornell's Legal Information Institute to make the primary sources of U.S. law more accessible, but also to assist those outside the legal profession in understanding them. As we look at the current environment, we need to look at the things that Cornell has done in the Legal Information Institute, but we need also to consider how those of us, particularly those of us with active foreign and international law programs, can work profitably with the broader free access to law movement, the global alliance of legal information institutes in other countries and regions. I participated last year in the Free Access to Law conference in South Africa and saw at firsthand the work that the legal information institutes in other countries are doing in facilitating electronic access to primary sources of law in countries where official access is limited. Understandably, given their mission and their commitments, the LIIs in these other countries provide only limited access to commentary in the law and legal scholarship. Yet, as Michael Carroll, a prominent open access advocate in law, has said, if access to law matters, access to legal scholarship must matter too. What also matters is how the two literatures, primary sources and secondary sources, the law and commentary on the law, are linked together, and how web tools can be used to better connect and to develop connections between commentary and the law, on the law, and the texts of the primary sources. Surely there's a role here for librarians seeking to serve the broader communities that open access to legal scholarship creates. One of the most intriguing papers presented at last year's Law Via the Internet conference was by Olivier Charbonneau, a librarian and doctoral candidate in law at Concordia University in Montreal, who works with Daniel Poulin and the Canadian Legal Information Institute. Charbonneau's work, similarly to Walensky's, is inspired by making information broadly available and making information access and discourse in law and in other disciplines fuller between the North and the South. His work is inspired by a report called Making the Law Work for Everyone, issued in 2008 by the UN Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor. This report argues that empowering the poor through improved dissemination of legal information and by the formation of peer groups for self-help are first step strategies toward justice. Then goes on to say that modern information and communications technologies are particularly well suited to support interventions geared toward strengthening information sharing groups, teaching the poor about their rights, and encouraging non-formal legal education. In his paper called Collaboration and Open Access to the Law, How Can Web 2.0 Technologies Help Us Understand the Law?, Charbonneau develops an intriguing model for describing the interactions between users and content, or between agents and documents, which are the terms he uses. And he proposes ways to use Web 2.0 applications to facilitate collaboration and sharing information about legal text by creating links between primary sources and formal or informal commentary on the text or point of law under study. His ideas in his paper were directed toward the members of the Free Access to Law movement, the 14 or so legal information institutes around the world, which, as I've said, focus on providing access to primary sources of law. But perhaps those of us at universities and law schools who are committed to providing open access to secondary sources, to the scholarship that's produced at our institutions, ought to be thinking about developing similar platforms to link out in the other direction, to link what we make available to sites hosting primary sources of law, while also providing space for discussion and questions. After all, we are now in a time when the U.S. National Archivist blogs about Martians in his personal blog and has also issued his agency's first open government plan, which proposes, among other things, a social catalog that encourages users of the archives to employ social media to contribute their own thoughts to descriptions of the documents in the archives. I saw David yesterday and was talking to him about that, and he says the professional archivists are not happy about this development. I saw David yesterday at a law.gov workshop at Duke, and the first question from the audience after my presentation was, how do we link access to scholarship and commentary about the law found in law school repositories to the repository of primary sources that the law.gov project is working on? By definition, open access initiatives expand the communities we serve. They create opportunities not only for new services, but also for librarians to use new tools and to develop tools to enable not only dissemination of information, but the creation of new knowledge. This is a time in which users of legal information are indeed faced with a new multiplicity of sources, a problem that is unlikely to be tamed by focusing on the development of local collections, but is more likely to be tamed by creative development of new tools and services, and by the use of those tools to generate new kinds of knowledges that serve not only our local communities, but also the broader communities that open access allows us to reach. Thank you.
Professor Danner, thank you. That's an inspiration for all of us who work in this field. Quite a wonderful tour of intellectual history as well as provocations for the future. So thank you. Lots to work on and perhaps to agree or disagree with. We have a few minutes. I would love it if, would you be willing to entertain a few Web 2.0 style social media old school questions? So who would like at it? And noting you'll be on the record for perpetuity when you do. Michelle.
So as a director of a law library, how would you advise, I mean, some universities are already very into the whole open access supporting scholarship concept. How would you advise people who are directors at other kinds of, at other law schools or other types of educational institutions, how they sort of make the case to their school administration about using resources for these kinds of projects that you're talking about?
Well, I think that the case is going to be made by what open access repositories accomplish in terms of exposing the work of the faculty of the school to others who will read it. You know, these things are lovely for their counts of downloads and hits. They're the sort of thing that deans and other administrators in law schools are normally going to be impressed by, as are alumni. And so I think that's where you make the case for doing it. But I think that many of the benefits, as I suggested, go beyond that. I think there are other things that we can accomplish that I think provide opportunities for us to make use of the fact that we have open access repositories. It's not that big a deal to create one. There certainly are financial and support issues that are involved, but many universities have repositories, as you do here. It's not that terribly expensive for a law school to create its own repository. So it's easy enough to do it. The question is, how do you make use of it to accomplish these other goals?
Moderator's prerogative to ask a second question, if that's okay, which is tomorrow, many of us, some of us in this room who are involved in thinking about foreign law collections are going to be talking about how we might work together more broadly. I wonder if you might take a moment just to bridge the thoughts that you've presented today, which I think foreshadow some of the conversation tomorrow, into that conversation.
I can't wait till tomorrow to do that. Well, as I suggested, I think that, you know, there one of the things that we face in having those discussions tomorrow is the question of how much do we rely on print-based foreign language materials? What do we need to collect? What do we have here? And for those of you who haven't been part of this conversation, we were all asked to do homework. We were supposed to respond to several questions, providing our thoughts on the issues that we were facing in building foreign law collections. Melanie and I both thought that the best answer to that was actually, much as I hate to say it, came from Blair Kaufman. Because while others were bemoaning having fewer resources to purchase materials and to house them and to collect them, Blair, in his usual fashion, said, I think this is the best of all times because there's so much information available electronically that basically solves most of our needs. And I think that's the thing that we need to think about. So what I would think about is tying in to, as I said in the talk, tying in more to these efforts around the world to make more law available locally and regionally, freely available to the people in the countries that are involved there. So what do we add to that? Well, I think what we add to that is we make use of the materials that they're making available. And those of us who have strong foreign and international programs, scholarship being produced, journals, and other things like this at our own institutions, make alliances with those groups to go in both directions, to provide commentary on questions of foreign and international law, but also to help them build up the collections that they're developing themselves, because they're going to be there, they're going to be freely available, and these are the directions that we need to be working in.
Fabulous. I think with that, we'll draw it to a close, but please join me in thanking Professor Danner again for this inspiration.
Thank you very much.